Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to have Tom Juhas join us as our guest. Tom was most recently the COO for Donnelley Financial Solutions, and currently serves as an advisor to the CEO there. And he has just a great career of international as well as domestic experience. And he's going to share some lessons learned in his career. And looking forward to today's conversation with Tom. Tom, I guess first off, can you give us just a little bit of your background, a little bit of your story?
Sure. 40 years and 4 minutes, right?
Yeah, right.
We'll try. So I was born and raised in New Jersey, where I'm sitting right now. I often joked, as you'll find out, I've moved all around the world, but I keep getting dragged back to New Jersey. So I guess it's in my roots. Take the boy out of New Jersey, but New Jersey not out of the boy. I went to Seton Hall College, University, went to the business school there. I did an internship in my senior year with IBM, but chose not to stay at IBM and went to a company called American Cyanamid. So it was a chemical company. I was in the plastics division, but some people remember them as having made Old Spice and Crowell shampoo and some of the other products, but I was in technical sales with Cyanamid. And then probably about 4 years in, a friend of mine was actually trying to be a professional umpire. And in the off season, he was an accountant for a company called Charles P. Young. And he was doing my taxes that year for me. And he introduced me to the company. It was Financial Printing. I had never heard of it. So this was circa 1984.
Okay.
And it's really a cottage industry, primarily serving lawyers, bankers, doing IPOs, M&A. It's really more of a service company that files documents with the SEC. So printing is just one of the services. So it's really, really didn't need to know too much about printing, but that's what they called it, financial printing. Fast forward, that company gave me the opportunity to go down to Miami and open up a satellite office. So it's pretty much my first introduction into true management, coming out of sales, true leadership. And unfortunately, that company fell to the crash of 1987. So, and I've seen some of your podcasts, you know, the ability to be agile and resilient hit me pretty early. Actually changed direction. I wound up going back to school. So with the time out down in Miami, I went to the University of Miami's business school, now called the Miami Herbert Business School. And it was a great 2 years to get my MBA there. Then R.R. Donnelly came knocking, and R.R. Donnelly was, and just up to recently, the largest printer in North America, headquartered out of Chicago. And they were moving into the financial printing space, looking to be number one in the industry, which caught my eye. But what I was also eyeing at the time was Europe, the UK and Europe, the privatizations that were going on in the capital markets. I thought there was a great opportunity to work there. And R. Donnelly gave me the opportunity to go there in about 1991, 92. And I spent a good decade there, based in the London office, but setting up the offices in EMEA and then eventually APAC. So I had quite a run. I met my wife there. We got married in England. We now live back here as well in New Jersey. So I came back to Donnelly in the U.S. Around 2004, 2005, as newly appointed president of what was the Financial Business Unit. So it was a division of R.R. Donnelly. And from there, the charter was really growing out a services group at R.R. Donnelly. So the core was this capital markets business and this mutual fund business. But then we got into, through either acquisition or organic growth or reorg, we created, let's say we went from about a $600 million business unit to about a $2.3 billion group that I headed up prior to the spin. And then in 2015, Ara Donnelly announced that they're going to split into three separate companies. And in October of 2016, Donnelly Financial Solutions spun out, spin, they call it, from Ara Donnelly in October 2016. And I went with the executive team as the chief operating officer. And it's a publicly traded company, a stock symbol DFIN. And up until just this past January, I was the COO. I've stepped down and I'm an advisor to the company now. That's I think that's 4 minutes. but it was 30 years at Ara Donnelly and Donnelly Financial combined. So it was quite a career there.
Very good. No, and we were introduced by a previous guest, Donette Beverly, who spoke highly of you, said you were one of the best leaders that she's ever worked with. So she definitely had high praise for you as a leader. Tell us
that's
a little bit.
Cost me on the golf course.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll take
it. She talks about that. Yes, that'll cost me.
Well, talk a little bit about, I love this question because everybody has a different slant on it, but if you were to spin back time, you know, thinking back, you've had a great career and thinking what you know now, what would you tell yourself as a 22-year-old Tom?
The thing that I've really realized over a period of time is the ability to be aware as a leader. But awareness is more than just, you know, it's self-awareness, it's organizational awareness, it's now very much in our time, cultural awareness, socioeconomical. So just, I think at 22, you're, of course you could be mature for your age, which was something people would say to me in my 20s, but I didn't have the experience. I didn't have the maturation. And so when I think of your question, looking back, I think that really purposefully being aware, like making a point to just be more aware of your surroundings. I think at that age, you're ambitious, maybe you're curious, you're, you know, you go right at it, and you maybe you're missing some key signs along the way. So I think looking back, I probably wasn't as aware as I would have liked to have been.
So is there any advice that you received that looking back on it, you should have ignored?
Well, as a first gen, so you know, family, some immigrants coming over and things like that. I was a first gen to go to college, and so I think within my close circle, my family, it was definitely a keep your head down. You're fortunate to get to go to college, and keep your head down, do a good job, and you'll get ahead in life, and things will take care of themselves. What I think that advice does, though, is it maybe stunts entrepreneurialism. So with entrepreneurialism comes some degree of risk, not too conservative if you're trying to do that. And a friend of mine, Robert Rubin, known him over the years, first as a client, now a good friend. He teaches entrepreneurialism, a class at Miami's Herbert Business School. Mm-hmm. And Dean Quelch, who's there now too, is new. He's fantastic. And I think I'm sure it's not unique, but to be teaching entrepreneurialism, planting those seeds in undergraduate school as well as grad school is just a fantastic thing. And I think looking back, no one gave me the advice to be an entrepreneur, right? It was more the other way. So, yeah.
So thinking back to that first time that you were tapped on the shoulder and said, you know, Tom, we've got this team that we want you to lead. Thinking back to that, and a lot of times people aren't prepared for that. They maybe have been successful doing a function and then all of a sudden they're tapped to lead a group. What do you wish you would have known prior to that?
My sports background, you know, loving team sports and things like that, I think allowed me to be much the team player. Mm-hmm. And I don't think at first I realized the importance of surrounding yourself with people who can do things you cannot do. So really making a much finer point of getting yourself surrounded by that. Really doing your homework going in. you know, at first you're trying to fit in, or maybe, you know, make sure it's a collegial team approach, but you truly are the captain. And the idea is that you're supposed to assess the team. And I learned over the years that you know, the third, a third, and a third, like a third of the team is all in. They're so glad you arrived. A third of the team, hell no, I won't go. And they're not really happy. And a third is just going to watch and see what happens. And I found that the third that were all in, maybe you don't want them to be all in. They're not really going to work out. Some that were not really pleased get involved, and you see something come from them. And then obviously, you know, the goal here is to get to 80% and everybody's, you know, rowing and aligned in the same direction. But I think a lot of the learning early on was just getting the perspective of each of the team members, and then and doing the assessment and learning. Usually it's a different, the reason you're plucked or you go somewhere is because it's not necessarily working right. So what is it that's, to what end are you trying to fix something or improve something?
So around those people decisions, trying to, you know, assess your team and figure out, you know, where the gaps are and where, you know, the players are that you want to keep on the team. Talk a little bit about kind of how your process when you're evaluating people, as far as if you're making a hire and adding to a team. What are some things that you've done and found that's been helpful as far as you think through assessing a person to bring on and to hire them to your group?
Well, it's interesting because at the last 5 years with the spin from R.R. Donnelly, we're setting up a new company. So it's a pure stand-up, 40-something transition service agreements, and got to cut the ties from the mothership. And a lot of new people came on board. So the recent experience, I've often used the approach, and I think if some people listen to this, they'll start laughing because I did it in their interviews, is I try to talk them out of the job. I take the part that, you know, I don't oversell what the situation is. I try to kind of put it in a genuine, authentic type approach so that the person arrives and there's really no surprises, so that you're not really wasting time going over things that they didn't expect or didn't know. And I think that helps get the fit right. The other thing too is I make sure, and I think this is key in a lot of things, is you tend to have one-on-ones with team members, and then you tend to have team functions. And as the leader, I think you need to make sure that your one-on-ones that you're saying in those meetings match up with what you say in the team meetings, so that there isn't two messages. So it isn't, well, when you're with Tom, he's talking like this, but then when he gets in the meeting, I think it's not as genuine. It could be disingenuous, not as authentic. So I think I try to find that balance on the team of making sure that everybody's building trust, genuine, staying authentic to what it is. And then I think that helps then move the needle on the team moving forward as one.
So when you're bringing somebody on, we've talked about as far as kind of the importance of making good decisions, but once that person is on the team, how do you help people succeed quicker? I think sometimes there's those months that go by that people are trying to get up to speed, but anything that you found that's helped your team get kind of a fast start as far as getting acclimated to your culture and your team?
Probably making sure that the actions they're taking align, or the belief that the tactical work is aligning with the strategic work, and asking kind of open probe questions, not challenge questions, but clarifying questions to say, well, why would we be doing this to build out a certain product or, you know, move a sales unit, make some changes, to what end is the objective? How are you going to register success in a year from now or 2 years or 3 years from now? And usually with those questions, it works back to what they're doing now. And maybe it's more eliminating things rather than increasing anything. It's just taking away things that really won't provide the value. The expression our CEO uses is the juice isn't worth the squeeze. So it's just eliminating some of that to get to that faster with the person.
So are there any books that have influenced you that you would recommend to other leaders that they should have on their reading list?
Well, a couple things. First of all, full disclosure, I've always been an audio learner. So I find this new age of podcasts. And by the way, thank you for doing these, not just for the audio learner, but you personally are, I guess, paying it forward or giving back by doing these. It's fantastic. So, you know, I would always go to the classes where the professor taught and tested you on most of what he taught in the classroom rather than what you had to read in the book. So that's probably how I survived. But so books. I would say that from a leadership perspective, the ones I remember that influenced me, and I was a Peter Drucker, a big fan of that back in, wrote my MBA on that and everything. But there was a book given to me when I started my international part of my career. It was called I'll Be Over in the Morning. I think it was by James Pilditch. He also did Winning Ways. And it really was the ability to how do you sell in foreign or international markets? Particularly, you know, you're based in the UK, you're American, and you're flying into France to sell something. You know, how do you do that? I thought that was really helpful. Then when R. Donnelly, we had acquired a couple of outsourcing companies, Office Tiger and Astron were the names, and they had large facilities in India, Philippines, and Sri Lanka. And someone gave me the book, The Argumentative Indian. And it was by last name is Sen, a Nobel Prize winner, economist, Indian. And I always remember reading that because it was more about culture and how it people think in India. And it was helpful to me as I was engaging over almost a 10-year period there. And most recently, I think, and this is the audio book I bought rather than the read book, is A Zone to Win. It was by Jeffrey Moore, and again, recommended. And here we are trying to transform the company, yet we have a lot to do for performance. So it's a transformation performance grid, and then these four zones, and you know, from incubation to productivity to performance. And I found that book really helpful to, again, set the stage for how do we want to think about strategically the transformation. So those, again, I don't know that people hear this, they're going to run out and buy those books. I think it's more of maybe the message is finding the read that fits the time. Other than that, I'm a big one on crime, not true crime, but Agatha Christie and Arthur Conan Doyle and those things. So I'll read them on my free time.
Good. So outside of work, besides reading and listening to books, what do you do to recharge?
I'd say that the perfect day, if I can pull it off on a weekend, is a good run, followed by a little gardening, followed by a cocktail around 5 o'clock with the barbecue going, and then an early night's sleep. So with no interruption. So that would probably be if I can get more of those in the coming year, that would be great.
Any parting advice that you'd give a newer upcoming leader that you think would be helpful?
I guess just, I put it into two buckets. I mean, the school book stuff around just accessibility, availability, visibility. I try to remember those. I mean, accessibility is not, the difference between that and availability really is it easy to get you? So can I access you? Whether it's an email, whether it's figuring out making it known how best to get you. Text me versus an email. So accessibility, don't go see my assistant and get an appointment, just so that. And then availability, particularly if it's global markets, 30, you know, like we are, 24/7, 365. It's he's in Hong Kong this week. Well, you have to still be available, much to my family's chagrin at times. And then visibility, the optics of that, just being out in front, I think is really valuable. The other thing that's very timely, and I knew we would be talking, and I went back to my Drucker stuff, is I found this, I was looking for it. The greatest danger in times of turbulence is not the turbulence. It is to act with yesterday's logic. And I think a lot of companies, ours included, is riding this turbulence out of this past pandemic, Black Lives Matter, and a lot of other things that are happening. And your natural inclination is to use some type of logic that you gained over a period of time, like myself with the 30 years, but is that really the right logic in these times? One would have argued as a leader, you'd never send home 65 or 80% of your workforce. They'll never get it done. They can't do it this way. And yet here we are standing up the company. So what's the logic been going forward in the years ahead? I think the leaders of tomorrow, today and tomorrow, that's a big challenge coming, is to think through how you're logically, how you're going to be running and leading companies in the new normal, whatever that is.
Well, I sure appreciate your thoughts today, Tom. This has been fun to talk to you, and definitely wish you continued success as you work at your role and helping your company continue to grow. And definitely wish you continued success.
Thank you. And again, thank you for doing these. I think you're definitely giving back. Paying it forward, Mark.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.